Rebecca is a well-known yachting journalist. She's written for Boat International, Super Sail World, Yachting World. Her new book, Wild Seas to Greenland, follows the refit and then the expedition of the 20-year-old aluminium yacht and her owner, Ross Field. Rebecca knew a bit about boats, but Ross won the Whitbread Round the World race back in the 90s aboard Peter Black Steinlager 2, and then again as skipper of his own yacht. He's won other big trophies as well, and he's a veteran of events like the Volvo race, which used to make Auckland a port of call. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Who's your readership for this book, do you think?
I started off thinking that it would be yachties, offshore yachties, because I've written for yachties for 30 years. But increasingly, as people have read it, they've lent it to their wife or their sister or, you know, just friends, people that are into DIY, people that are adventurers at heart. So it's gone wider and wider than I imagined.
I didn't expect your book. I mean, we thought it was a good idea to talk to you because of the intrepidness of the voyage. But I expected, you know, plain sailing in the writing, as it were. And as a non-sailor, and on the odd occasions when I have sailed, a very bad sailor, I'm sorry to say, I thought I might be uninterested in the technical parts of it. But in fact, it's really interesting how you kit a boat out for a big voyage and the decisions you have to make. It really is fascinating.
Yeah, and what I found really interesting about this is that Ross Field is a racing sailor. So, I mean, I've covered a lot of refits of yachts by a cruising skipper, but I knew that he would bring a racing perspective, and it's different. Because I think the hardest part of any project is not doing the work, it's planning the work. And that's what he is really good at. He's got a very sharp mind, very methodical. And so that's of more use to the reader, I felt, so they can apply that thinking to their project.
Ross Field, in the main photo of him, in your book, which I am now showing you, is the spitting image of Gene Hackman.
Oh, yeah, I can see that.
You know, that would pass, actually, out of interest, as a publicity shot for the actor Gene Hackman. They look so similar. And he's a real-life tough guy, Ross.
He is a tough guy, yeah. He's a really interesting character, actually. I mean, he's highly intelligent. He's adult ADHD, so he's always thinking. You know, there's always some plan or some project underway. And he can be quite funny, but man, he can be tough. And he can be incredibly kind. And, you know, like the funny thing for me was that he's used to sailing around the world with literally some of the best sailors in the world. And then here he was with me, and I'm, you know, pretty amateur in my sailing. But he was really patient when I did something stupid, most of the time.
Yeah, most of the time. And we'll get back to Ross, but I want to ask you a bit about Adrian, your dad. There's a quote from him at the start of the book. I would not do that voyage again for £500, but nor would I have missed it for £1,000. He was a good sailor, your father. He was an ocean sailor too. He was very accomplished.
Well, he wouldn't actually agree with you on that. I mean, he is very well known for sailing single-handed around the world before any other New Zealander had done it. When he started, he had no experience.
Yes.
He went out of desperation following the war. And he would often said that in terms of trimming of sails to go fast, he was hopeless. But he was a very good seaman and he was very tough. It's not like he spent his life sailing. You know, he made these two massive voyages and that was pretty much it.
First person to sail solo from the UK to New Zealand, having learned navigation by correspondence.
Yeah.
That's just amazing.
Well, he actually left England having given up on the books. And he thought, oh, I'll figure it out when I get out there, which is sort of what happened.
The Military Cross in Burma, 1944, sailing instructor at Outward Bound, the MBE, head of our Antarctic mission, and obviously a good writer of various books. It was actually a pleasure finding out about him.
Oh, good.
It's a brainwave to have him in the book. And I thought it very sad at the start of your book, before you set sail, when your dad dies, and you nurse him, you and your sister, holding his hand at the end. And you're only able to rally yourself at that point in your life and tend to him properly because of Reiki.
Oh, yeah, that was interesting. So, I mean, I was only 26 and I was actually terrified of the sick room. And I mean, it would send me into panic attacks. But because I loved him, I thought, well, okay, I'm just going to have to overcome this. But I was looking after him pretty much on my own, very isolated place about an hour out of Nelson, So obviously I was getting to a point where I was very stressed, and I'd only just realised that he was dying, like, which I know sounds ridiculous, but up until then we were fighting to, you know, we were fighting to beat the cancer. I was constantly in tears. My neck was just like steel wires of pain. And then this woman called Jessica came to visit to say goodbye, and she took one look at me and realised what a state I was in. And she gave me Reiki, which is a hands-on energy healing. And I was like, oh, for God's sake, I'll go and do it to be polite. But, you know, wasn't into it at all. And then I, you know, she finished and I got up and I went into the kitchen and someone said, so how do you feel? And I, oh, my God, I feel fine. And from then on, I was fine to the end.
I was very interested in that in the book. There are passages from your father's book, His Writings at Sea, in your own book, which is a great idea. He says, in the middle of the ocean, he felt solitude without loneliness, and sometimes an understanding came which brought deep peace, which I don't understand, of course. Did you ever feel that?
Oh, definitely. Definitely, yeah. And I don't think it has to be at sea. I think it can be in the bush. And sometimes you just feel so complete in yourself. And something that fascinates me about being on the ocean, you know, you're on a boat that's only 55 feet long, but, and I think I say this in the book, but you're kind of in infinity. And so you're just a tiny little speck in the great order of things. And I guess that feels like there's no pressure on you or something, you know, and just, you're just in awe of it all, especially at night, because the stars are so bright because there's no ambient light. And sometimes you'll see a shooting star and the light, it's like a scar across the sky that stays for a second or two. It can even light up the mainsail for a few seconds.
Mm.
And it's, you just know that you're so lucky to be there.
Wild Seas to Greenland. We haven't got on the Wild Seas yet. You have quite a poetic bent. I'm quoting, every time I sail, I ride the bow where the wind, father, for you. I know you've sailed those winds too. So the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, or the anchor doesn't fall far from the boat or something. Perhaps another metaphor apart from that. But you are your father's daughter.
Oh, increasingly, yeah. I mean, I battled that for a little while because I was trying to break out and be a journalist all by myself, and people kept on saying, oh, you're Adrian Hayter's daughter. And I was like, oh, look, go away, Dad. I want to do this on my own. But then at some point I realised that people can admire Dad and have Adrian Hayter, and that's their version of him.
Yep.
But only I've got Dad, and I made my peace with that. And that poem that I quote there, I actually wrote that in the memoriam, the first anniversary of his death, when I was really struggling. I mean, I missed him for a long time. And so that's where that came from.
You see, I mean, I'm not going to dwell on the, you know, speck and the vast infinity on the ocean, but there's a touch in this book of that line from the Crosby, Stills and Nash song, Southern Cross, spirits are using me, larger voices calling. There is that aspect to your book as well, isn't there?
Oh, definitely. And it's really hard to put your finger on it. And I guess, I mean, and Dad talked about it a lot, you know. I mean, I think in a city environment, it's easy to lose touch with that sometimes. But the other thing too is on a boat, a lot of the time there's nothing to do. You know, if the sails are set and you've done the dishes or whatever. So you actually spend a lot of time with yourself, capital S for self, you know. Yeah, so you do get a bit introspective and thinking about how the world is and what you're going to do next.
How did you get immersed in the Wild Seas to Greenland? Because you'd met Ross Field a bit and he had given you some good advice about your own sailing at one point.
Yeah, he came up to our stand at the boat show and I was like, oh my goodness, Ross Field's coming. Oh my goodness, he's a famous person. I get nervous around famous people. And, you know, so come up with a question. And I knew that he'd owned a Young 88 and I co-owned a Young 88. So
what's a Young 88?
A Young 88 is a 30-foot yacht, a racer cruiser, right. Very, very popular in Auckland or New Zealand. And it was our nationals coming up. So I thought, well, you know, I'll ask him a question about that. And, yeah, I mean, he asked me out to dinner as a result of that and then took me sailing several times. And, you know, and then he went to England. He found the boat in France and went to England to refit it. And as I say, he's ADHD. He gets these crazy ideas. So he sent me this text saying, do you want to do the Northwest Passage with me? And I said no.
Yes, well, you said no for a while, but then he paid the airfare in the end, didn't he?
Yeah, and also I said to him, I just want to know that I'm not going to die. And he said, you're not going to die. And so for me, the reason, I mean, I knew it was a fantastic adventure, but I also knew what can go wrong.
Why did he want you along as a kind of civilizing influence?
Well, he wanted crew. He knew that I had done enough sailing to be useful. And he also thought it would be good to have a journalist. Yeah, and, you know, one thing he has said, which was core for me in writing the book, he said, you know, you've picked up knowledge from me in the way that I run the boat that can help to save lives at sea, and especially with the weather routing, which I've talked about quite a lot.
Yes.
And he feels really passionate about that. You know, when he hears of a sailor that's died at sea, I mean, we all feel it, but he really feels it. So that was sort of something that emerged down the track. But, I mean, initially he thought that, you know, in doing the Northwest Passage, it would be great to have a journalist on board.
You didn't do it, though, in the end. So what was the plan? What was the plan as you set out for Greenland?
Well, it's hard to have a plan because you don't know if the Northwest Passage will open. So we sailed from England. As it happened, we went into Ireland to miss some bad weather. And then you set off for Greenland. And it's really hard to get a lot of information about it before you go, actually.
Tell us about Rosemary.
Oh, my God. Rosemary is lovely. She's a 55-foot French design boat, bare aluminium, the strongest boat I've ever been on, a safest boat. So she was about 20 years old. She had been built for high latitude, which is the Arctic or Antarctic cruising, which means she's pretty strong. Her bottom plates are 20 mil. So she would bounce off a little bit of ice with no problem. And by the time Ross found her, she'd been sitting neglected for a couple of years. She was very complicated in terms of the way that she was fitted out, which he immediately approached her with, like, simplify, and he stripped a lot of stuff out of her. I never felt scared on that boat.
You see, he takes the buoyancy tanks out. He considers those unnecessary. I'd be thinking, in the event of an emergency, I'd like these tanks to fill up with air, thank you, and keep the boat afloat.
Yeah, it wasn't actually buoyancy tanks. Buoyancy tanks.
Buoyancy bags.
Yeah, what she had was these basically scuba diver tanks connected to these bladders. And if the boat was hulled, then you set off this system and those bladders would instantly inflate and keep the boat afloat.
Yeah.
I think he had so much confidence in the boat and his ability for weather routing, etc. He didn't think they'd be necessary. And also they take up a lot of space. You know, and everything you have on a boat is something else that can go wrong or cause a problem.
Airbags in the car take up space too, of course.
Yeah,
I've got a landlubber's attitude towards all this.
Yeah, well, I mean, that actually raises an interesting point. I mean, they always say, you know, look after yourself first. The boat will look after itself. And your greatest risk on a boat through carelessness is a broken arm or a broken leg through not holding on in rough weather. So it's a matter of keeping yourself safe.
Wild Seas to Greenland, and Rebecca Hayter is with us. Now, it's quite interesting when Ross buys the boat, how the guy he hires to give her the once-over knows she is a strong craft, what he sees inside the boat that tells him that. Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, basically, if a boat is built very stiff and very strong, it won't move. And you obviously have doors and drawers and cupboards inside a boat. And if the outer shell of the boat is moving and warping, then you'll go to close the cupboard and it won't close, you know, because the interior cabinetry is shifted with the outer shell of the boat. And so if that happens, somebody will have planed off the bottom of the cupboard door or the main door, whatever, to make it fit. And he could tell that the doors had never been planed down, so they'd never had a problem fitting, so therefore the outer shell had never warped.
I found that really interesting. So I'll skip over the refit, and people who own yachts can read all about it. She was as strong as an ox, as you're saying, the Rosemary. So four of you hop on board in the UK and set sail to Greenland.
Mm-hmm. The big issues were, as we sort of hit the bottom corner of Greenland and started heading north, the autopilot started going completely crazy. It would suddenly do a hard left-hand turn or right-hand turn, starboard port, whatever. And that was because it was getting close to the magnetic North Pole. And obviously an autopilot runs off a compass, which I hadn't actually figured that out. And we had the wrong type of compass for that. So it's an example of just being unable to get the right information. The other problem we had was that we had electronic charts of all the fields in Greenland, but most of them had no detail on the chart. there's only a few places that actually had the detail, like the depths and rocks and hazards and things. And we found out later that was because when the Greenland and the Canadian government started transferring the paper charts to electronic charts, they knew there were a lot of mistakes in them and they didn't want to be responsible for them. So they just left all those areas out. So, and of course, when Ross got the charts in England, it all looked fantastic. It wasn't until he started looking at the more obscure places that he realised there was no detail.
So that's why most Kiwi sailors don't go to Greenland, isn't it?
There
wouldn't be many who go up there.
No, very few. I mean, for a start, it's an incredibly long way away.
Yeah, it is.
And also, you know, people have only just started going to Greenland in bigger numbers because the Northwest Passage has only just started opening every year.
Mm.
And so, because the Northwest Passage has opened, a lot of other boats are now just going to Greenland to get that Arctic experience.
Yeah. 56,000 people in Greenland total, living in 97 different communities. So it's not crowded, is
no,
it?
No, it's the least densely populated country in the world.
No trees, but all the houses are made of timber.
Yeah, it's very dependent on Denmark.
Right.
In fact, they're sort of trying to get a bit more independent from Denmark, but at the same time they want all the advantages of being dependent on
yes.
Denmark. So they've got a little bit of a problem there.
You had a stormy trip there. You had a stormy trip back again. You really struck it rough in places on the Atlantic.
No, not at all. I mean, it's actually the North Atlantic, not the Atlantic. And the North Atlantic is a pretty ferocious ocean.
Yeah. Okay. The mountains of Greenland right on the water. Spectacular. You say like being able to sail all the way up to the Southern Alps.
Oh, it was. If you imagine the Southern Alps of New Zealand flooded, sort of up to their shoulder height and then being on a boat around them, that's what it felt like.
Yeah,
and
marvellous.
That's probably what it is. You know, the mountains are just sticking out the top.
It doesn't pay to look out the back of the yacht when you're in a storm in the North Atlantic.
Oh, I think that was one of Ross's Whitbread jokes. You know, he had another one, icebergs go away at night.
Yeah,
and you know, he said, "Don't look out the back." And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Because the waves are so big." And I literally had to go up into the cockpit and look out from under the pilot house roof to see the top of the wave.
Yeah, that's right. You did look back.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Someone tells you not to walk on the grass. You want to walk on the grass.
Yeah,
don't you?
And you saw this giant wave following you, and yet you conquered your fear of deep water sailing. And on a previous long voyage, you'd been beset with anxiety during bad weather, and in good weather you were anxious about the bad weather to come. So how come you suddenly got calm in an environment like this?
It wasn't sudden. It's been an evolution. I mean, I spent about 20 years with panic attacks and phobias and all sorts of things, and I find that really interesting, actually. I was terrified of flying, and I did a Flying Without Fear course at Air New Zealand, which was fantastic. I also did a couple of chakra courses about energy fields around your body where you sort of look at yourself in all sorts of ways and learn tools from that. I also confronted an abusive situation that I'd experienced as a child, hardest thing I've ever done. And, you know, so you actually face the bogeyman, you know, and that had a massive effect on me. And after that, I was no longer scared of the dark. I mean, I was scared of the dark until I was 46.
Really?
Yeah. The sea hasn't changed, but I'd changed. In fact, those seas were easily the biggest seas I'd ever been in a small boat. But also, I was in an incredibly safe boat and an incredibly skilled skipper.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
Even so, it's been a journey in more ways than one for your good self. Unlike your dad's long voyages, you had the latest weather technology. Do you call it routing technology?
Weather routing, yeah.
What is that?
Obviously, you can download weather information or, say, a weather forecast up to 10 days out now in digital form. Mm-hmm. So, therefore, you can incorporate it into the boat's chart plotter and navigation system. He could download the information for the dates that he wanted, for the piece of ocean that he wanted, and overlay it over his boat on the course across the North Atlantic. The software knew how fast the boat would travel at different angles to the wind in different conditions. So it would say, okay, if you set off now on this course with the weather forecast that we've got, in 2 days' time, you're going to be in 40 knots from the north.
Right.
And Ross might say, okay, that's not acceptable. So he'd say, find me another way. So he would set parameters. I don't want to sail in more than 25 knots of wind, which it turned out that wasn't possible that day. And I don't want to sail lower than 150 degrees apparent wind because he didn't have a spinnaker. So, and then he could also interrogate the information. Like, for example, if it said that a low pressure system was going to go down to 1,000 and he thought it might go to 995 millibars, he would say, well, what would happen then? And it might be a scenario that was just completely unacceptable, like 50 knots. Mm. So he'd say, right, not gonna take that risk.
Okay. Marvellous.
Yeah, but the thing about it, I mean, like, a lot of people think they have weather routing now, but they use an incredibly simplified form and they don't take the effort to really understand the weather systems and where they are. Like, Ross put a lot of time into it. You know, so it's all very well knowing that you might end up in, there's a possibility, say a 20% chance you're going to end up in 50 knots in 2 days' time. So change what you're doing now. Slow the boat down. Go another way, you know. And one thing that Ross is adamant about is that if somebody's got to meet a flight schedule or be at work on Monday or whatever, that is not going to dictate what he does on the boat.
Wild Seas to Greenland, a sailing adventure with ocean racer Ross Field. Rebecca Hayter is with us. Interesting tidbits. Do people really eat barnacles off the bottom of a boat when they run out of food at sea?
Probably not, but my father had to.
Did he?
Yeah.
Do you have to make sure it's the right kind of barnacle? Is it a bit like mushrooms?
He said they were on a, they were goose barnacles, and they were on a kind of a stalk, which was too rubbery to eat, but he could get the bit that was in the shell and pull it off and boil it up and make a soup out of it.
Your father nearly ran out of water. In fact, he got to New Zealand, it seems, by the skin of his teeth.
Yeah, he never had enough money, so he was always sort of short of food before he started, and his sails were pretty old and tatty. And, you know, and a boat didn't perform as well as boats do nowadays.
Yeah.
So I think it took him about 6 weeks to get across the Tasman Sea, and so that's when he started running out of food.
When you came back across the North Atlantic two-handed, just you and Ross on the boat coming back, heading back to Britain, you say in the book, even though I looked forward to being there, i.e. your destination, I knew how lucky I was to be here. How lucky? What do you mean lucky?
Well, I'm a good sailor in terms of casual club racing around the Harbour Gulf. I'm not a great sailor, but I mean, I'm pretty average. And to have an opportunity like that, you know, on the North Atlantic, which is one of the, you know, most tumultuous oceans on the planet, with a skipper like Ross Field and a boat so well prepared, that just doesn't happen to someone like me, you know? I mean, I just...
No, I guess not.
Yeah.
There are decisions to be made as you head back. Knowing when to jibe is a really important one, isn't it? Now, you're explaining this to a novice, so could you explain it?
That was in terms of the weather routing. So obviously, as we worked our way through the weather systems across the North Atlantic, it was a matter of staying with the good weather for now, or the best weather, and then finding like a motorway off-ramp off that weather, you know, another change in the wind or a different sailing angle, as we looked down the track, looked into the future, we would remain in manageable conditions.
Right.
Because we were going west to east across the North Atlantic, and so was the weather. So if we got into the wrong weather, it would be very hard to get out of it again, you know, because you're both sort of travelling together.
Yep.
So we used Ross and his son, who was in communication with us, they would look at the barometric pressure and the wind angle, because obviously they're sort of constantly evolving as weather evolves, and that would be our cue to jibe.
Okay. It's complicated, this modern sailing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's easier when you look at it on a computer screen and you can see the isobars and...
Yeah. Amazing. And since that voyage, you've sailed more blue water.
Yeah, I did a crossing across the Atlantic the following year from British Virgin Islands to Bermuda and then across to the Azores.
Okay. What's Ross doing with himself these days?
He sailed around the Mediterranean and then he was going to sail the boat back to New Zealand, but because of COVID, etc., so he brought it out here on a ship.
So Rosemary's in New Zealand?
Yep, she's at Gulf Harbour.
So people can go and have a look at her?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, she's bare aluminium. A bare aluminium boat always looks pretty intrepid.
Yeah. Yeah, rugged,
yeah,
tough.
Yeah.
So what voyages lie ahead? Where would you love to sail one day?
Adventures have a way of presenting themselves somewhere. And I mean, I would never in a million years have dreamt of going to Greenland. So,
no.
Yeah, I guess whatever opportunity came up, I would look at it. I wouldn't be interested in the Southern Ocean.
No, I imagine that's just a bit too intrepid, isn't
yeah.
it? Is it in the blood, sailing? You're a sailor or you're not, born under a water sign or whatever. Is it genetic?
Well, people often say, you know, you must be good at that because you're Adrian Hayter's daughter. And I say, well, I've got two sisters that are Adrian Hayter's daughter and it's not for them, you know.
Right.
But there's no doubt. I mean, my great-grandfather was a sailor and we were brought up on stories of sailing and especially Dad and I mean, we just talked about it all the time.
He'd be proud of you, I think.
Yeah, I think he'd be proud of me. And then he'd say, I'm proud of all my daughters. And then he'd change the subject so it didn't go to my head. But he'd be quietly delighted that I went to sea.
In the end, it was smooth sailing, wasn't it? I mean, the seas were quite monstrous at times. It was as rough as all get out. And you were miserably ill at one point. But in fact, it was all right.
It was all right because the boat was so well prepared and because Ross put so much time into weather routing. So we were never caught out. We were never taken by surprise. Nothing ever broke. And that's actually pretty unusual on a boat.
It's kind of a must-read book for anyone planning a long boat trip, don't you think?
I hope so. I hope so.
It's a kind of how to do it properly.
Yeah, it's not covering all bases, but it's certainly got some really good tips in there.
So a lot of tips and tricks, but also a lot of soul.
Actually, I hope
so. More soul than you probably intended, but comes through.
Yeah, I always say I say things to my readers I wouldn't tell my best friend.
Very good of you to come in and talk to us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.